Welcome back. I'm Peter St. Ange. This is a weekly roundup of my daily videos on the economy and freedom, where I try to cut through the BS and the smoke and mirrors and lay out exactly what the clowns are trying to do to you and what is coming next. Troubled regional banks are turning to hot money using expensive brokered deposits to shore up their draining balance sheets, then cranking out risky loans to stay one step ahead of the debt collector. What could go wrong? Last quarter, the deposit exodus from regional and community banks stabilized, but it turns out there's a very good reason for that. They are essentially renting deposits from the major banks like Morgan Stanley or Fidelity. So-called brokered deposits involve the regional paying higher rates, often 5% or more, for a bundle of customer deposits moved over from a major bank. They do this so they don't appear to be losing deposits, but the problem is it costs them roughly 5 times more than real customer deposits, meaning they have to make increasingly risky loans to service the hot money. Now, regulators, including the FDIC, had long seen brokered deposits as red flags, as hot money, since the actual depositors don't have a relationship with the bank, meaning they could flee if the bank runs into any trouble. Nonetheless, those deposits are now rising fast. Beggars can't be choosers, and regulators are abnormally happy to look the other way these days. Such deposits have already doubled since the bank crisis in March, as nearly $500 billion was rented up by regionals to hide their holes, bringing broker deposits well over $1 trillion and rising, to the point they already make up nearly 1 in 10 deposit dollars in weaker banks. In case you're wondering, banks making particular use of broker deposits include Truist, Comerica, Zions, and some of the banks on the March hospice list, like Western Alliance. The fundamental problem is that the Fed's rate hikes have gouged a hole in regional bank vaults, and they're desperately using whatever they can to hide it. The Fed is already lending over $100 billion on fictitious asset prices to hide losses, the BTFP program, and now major banks are making a ton renting out deposits so regionals can continue to hide their depositor erosion. Of course, both are likely to get worse as the Fed continues hiking rates, including a fresh bump just last week. It would be really nice to have a banking system that was actually sustainable rather than one held together with duct tape, bailing water, BTFPs, and brokered deposits all smoke and mirroring their way to paper solvency using taxpayer handouts and shell games. Alas, generations of lobbyists have dedicated their lives to building our ruling Ponzi scheme, and especially the megabanks love the system just the way it is. They make money when it works. They make even more money when it breaks. Wall Street has installed a gigantic wealth siphon, draining the rest of America, even draining the junior bankers treading water in flyover country. They will keep patching it, keep it limping along just above the waterline, generating easy profits until voters stop them. The 100-year-old Yellow Trucking Company, familiar to generations of road-tripping Americans everywhere, went bust last week, despite a $700 million taxpayer bailout and throwing 30,000 mostly blue-collar workers out of a job. What put Yellow down was a three-punch from government mandates, sophisticated financial engineers, and old-fashioned Teamsters. And more are coming. I mentioned in a recent video how the worst inflation in 50 years is finally trickling down to workers, kicking off eye-watering wage demands from unions. The Teamsters were demanding from Yellow a $20,000 pay hike while blocking the company's efforts to reduce costs, to keep more people on the payroll. They knew Yellow could not pay. Yellow was just this side of solvent, with a debt totaling $1.5 billion, or 57 times their annual profit. But the Teamsters appear to have made a strategic decision to kill the company, to mount it on the wall as a warning to the bigger negotiations to come. The parasite killing the host to warn the rest. So Yellow will not be the last. In another recent video, I mentioned that hundreds of thousands of union workers are on the edge of striking, meaning this existential game of chicken is just beginning. The United Auto Workers just issued a 46% hike to the big three automakers that reads more like a hostage negotiation. United Airlines just agreed to a 40% hike. Rail workers got 24%. Even the post office, which cannot strike, still snagged 6,000 a year. Biden's inflation is going to keep disrupting and hitting especially manufacturers, emboldening unions that have spent decades turning swaths of America into Rust Belt, with an invaluable assist from governments laying impossible regulations and mandates, especially on manufacturing, and financiers who drain out the company before the union does it for them. For decades now, thousands of manufacturers could not survive all that. Already, millions of manufacturing jobs have been wiped out, bringing total manufacturing employment from 22% of workers in 1979 to just 8% today. Those companies who have survived this gauntlet are now pinched between debt, regulators, and unions looking for payback for 3 years of inflation, all competing to fleece what's left of American manufacturing. So what happens next? The companies that can handle the unions that have pricing power will pass the costs on to customers. So expect to pay thousands more for cars, expect cheap flights to evaporate. But many companies won't be able to handle the pay hikes and they will slip under the water, their business gobbled up by the big guys or by China. Many of those, like Yellow, which was founded in 1929, the eve of the Depression, many of those will be multi-generation businesses, legacies of that age before politicians, financiers, and unions salted the earth for American manufacturing. Once they're gone, they will stay gone. Fresh off Fitch's belated downgrade of the drunkest sailors in Washington, a major credit agency once again recognized reality as Moody's downgraded a bevy of regional banks that together represent 1/7 of the American banking system. What set Moody's off was concerns about, quote, rising funding costs, capital weakness, and asset risk. In other words, it's getting hard for regional banks to borrow money since investors are afraid that they'll go bust. This is draining their cash buffers, even as they're already losing money on what's already in the vault, especially commercial real estate, as America's cities go full Mad Max barter town. Sadly, neither Yellen nor Powell popped out to reassure Americans that our Ponzi banks are sound enough to squeeze out another 6 weeks of spring. Moody's downgrades included M&T with $200 billion in assets, plus a rogues gallery who collectively have another $400 billion, so about the scale of the banks who've already gone under. Moody's also put some pretty big banks on review for downgrade, including U.S. Bancorp, America's seventh biggest, Truist, which is number 9, Mellon, number 13, and State Street at number 15. I mentioned Truist the other day as one of the biggest users of, quote, brokered deposits, renting deposits from other banks to appear healthy, which is kind of sketchy. Together with the downgrades, that comes to roughly 1/7 of the entire U.S. banking system. In a final kick to the head, Moody's tossed some more banks on negative outlook, including America's eighth biggest bank, PNC, and Capital One with $471 billion in their wallet. So why so serious? Moody fingered the Fed that the, quote, wind down of unconventional monetary policy, meaning hiking rates to cancel the Fed's inflation, is hurting banks' cost of capital asset values. They are too polite to mention the assist from dying cities hitting commercial real estate, which regional banks specialize in. In response to the downgrade, the KRE, which measures regional bank stocks, fell almost 5% before recovering some of that through the day. But even the major banks got hit, since they've got the same problems in less concentrated form and, of course, with more senators on speed dial. So what is next? Moody's noted that the banks in question are already cutting back on loans, which preserves their money, but it could turn them into walking dead. After all, if your old loans aren't paying anything thanks to the Fed's low rates, plus you can't get new money, plus you're afraid to make new loans, you're pretty much running down the clock. At this point, essentially every bank who doesn't have a Wall Street address is running down the clock, living off taxpayer-funded cheap loans, regulatory smoke and mirrors, and slush funds like the BTFP or the FHLB. Given some of the top banks in America were on this hit list, collectively representing 1/7 of the entire banking system, when recession fully hits, we could see another wave of die-offs, and we will certainly see another round of $1 trillion taxpayer bailouts. The regime's hard sell of the soft landing scenario, where we dodge the recession, has hinged above all on allegedly strong job numbers. Fresh data is now saying that strong as hell jobs market isn't all it's cracked up to be. That it's actually made of part-time jobs cannibalizing full-timers, while even the headline numbers are fading fast. Last week, the BLS reported payrolls grew by 187,000 nationwide, the worst in almost 3 years. That was a 20,000 miss to expectations, so about 6%, but the big miss was the revisions. The previous 2 months were revised down for a total miss of 62,000 jobs, or 31%. I've mentioned how every payroll number this year has been revised down after the fact, presumably because the White House knows the media doesn't report revisions the way it reports the fresh numbers. They can take credit now and bury the revisions. They can do this since a big part of the jobs numbers are actually statistical models. They're not sitting counting everybody. Those models include things like massaged birth death figures on business starts that can give you whatever number you want. In fact, that birth death model may be accounting for most of the jobs allegedly being created at the moment. Worse than the misses and the models is what happens when we look under the hood at the quality of the jobs, meaning how many of those jobs are actually part-time or temporary, not the real jobs people imagine are being reported, the ones built into those soft landing predictions. My colleague EJ Antoni broke it down. Comparing payroll numbers to the separate household survey implies that more than two-thirds of the new jobs are actually part-time jobs. I mentioned in a recent video how DoorDash and, of course, government workers are basically holding up this labor market. Worse, the household survey showed that multiple job holders are soaring to the point that double counting could account for the entire payroll gain. In other words, there's a good chance the economy employed zero additional people last month. Put it together, and the entire strong jobs story, it turns out, is part-time and temp jobs. Controlling for those, and this is per the household survey, last month, full-time jobs actually fell by 585,000, which is a fairly large number. Those, of course, were swamped by almost a million part-time gigs to give the media something nice to talk about. So what is next? Falling full-time jobs with inflation that's now expected to start rising again means we could be looking at a 1970s-style stagflation, stagnant jobs and rising prices. That would pull down the dollar, it would drive up bankruptcies, and it would, of course, pump up those bank bailouts. It could even throw millions of Americans out of work, like last time in the 70s, to become statistical props. There was a time when government numbers were meant to be a control panel showing us the health of the economy. Those days are unfortunately gone. New inflation data came out yesterday, and it looks like inflation is rising again. Will the Fed go full goblin mode? July CPI numbers came in at 3.3% on the year, up from last month. Core inflation, which is the one the Fed cares most about, was once again stuck, unchanged on the month and year-on-year at 4.7%. That would mark the 32nd month now of core stuck above 4.5%. That's 2 years and 8 months of transitory inflation. I've mentioned in previous videos how the Fed believes the longer core is stuck, the more entrenched inflation becomes. People come to expect it, so they raise prices and demand pay hikes instead of buying the transitory line. Indeed, we are seeing that now. I recently mentioned car workers are demanding 46% pay hikes. United Airlines just gave 40%. And UPS just agreed to a new contract that pays delivery men $170,000 per year. I know I'm also wondering if I picked the wrong industry. What's concerning is the biggest thing holding inflation down this past year has been energy. As global recession and post-Ukraine normalization pulled gas prices down 20% and energy overall down 12.5%. But that is now reversing, with oil prices up 24% in the past 6 weeks as major producers, including Saudi Arabia, strangle production while Joe Biden wipes out domestic oil to entertain environmentalists. Meanwhile, the main drivers of inflation, which are shelter and food, are both continuing or getting worse. worse. Food shortages in particular are on the horizon worldwide from a combination of anti-agriculture policy, rising prices and capital costs, with an assist from the weather. In other words, the low-hanging fruit has been picked, and now inflation could go from stuck to rising again. The worst case scenario for the Fed is what happened in the 1970s. After inflation soared to double digits in 1973, it came back down and was stuck at 6% core for about 2 years, immediately followed by a resurgence back up to double digits for almost 5 years. Even worse than the first go-round. Now, 6% is just over a point above where we're stuck today, 4.7, and the Fed can read those charts too. So what is next? Beyond individual prices, the real driver of inflation is money supply. I've mentioned that money supply is now shrinking at the fastest rate since the Great Depression, partly by Fed tapering, but mostly because bank lending is slowing. But a recent article by Ryan McMacken at the Mises Institute calculates that we've still got around $4 trillion in money destruction, that's about 22%, just to get back to the pre-pandemic trend. That's not pre-pandemic prices, that's just the trend. This is unlikely to happen without breaking a lot more financials, which the Fed and Treasury are apparently unwilling to do. Their response to March was to pump out yet more money. So in all likelihood, the money supply will not sort itself out. Rather, all that money will keep gradually leaking out from savings to spending, meaning elevated inflation for years to come. Maybe in a few years, $170,000 will seem cheap for a delivery guy. Over half of China's economy is now shrinking, with youth unemployment hitting record highs. Has China entered the doom loop? Fresh data says China's exports are plunging at the fastest pace since the COVID lockdowns, 14.5% down on the year. That's mainly driven by a 23% drop in exports to the U.S. and a 21% drop to Europe and most of Asia. Meanwhile, imports are also falling 12.5% on the year, as factories in China buy fewer inputs and Chinese households reduce spending. In short, foreigners aren't buying and Chinese aren't buying either. This is all a problem for Chinese factories because they are obscenely overbuilt thanks to cheap money. To give a sense, Chinese car makers can produce 40 million cars a year, but Chinese only buy 20 to 25 million. China's now actually throttling new car production, denying them production licenses, even as the U.S. is pouring billions of taxpayer dollars into an industry that will soon be swamped by cut-rate Chinese EVs. Now, manufacturing makes up just over 27% of the Chinese economy, and it has contracted for 4 straight months now, bringing quarterly GDP growth nationwide to just 0.8%. That's pretty low for China. The economy just officially entered deflation for the first time since the 2008 crisis. Meanwhile, in the rest of the Chinese economy, their comically indebted housing industry, also roughly one quarter of GDP, is showing new distress. Major home builder Country Garden, which was held up by China's government as the poster child of prudence, just missed 2 bond payments on their total $200 billion in debt, leading to a debt downgrade from the now famous Moody's. Considering this is all coming with youth unemployment at a record high, over 20%, it could spell political trouble. So what can China do? The exports are largely out of their control. It's basically our recession talking, and that's likely to get worse, meaning more plunging exports and falling factory prices in China. Eventually, enough Chinese factories close that the overcapacity dries up and prices can recover. Of course, that could mean millions more freshly jobless Chinese youth. As for domestic demand, including housing, China's go-to whenever the economy slows is to crank out more cheap money, cutting interest rates and handing tens of billions to home builders or local governments, digging holes and refilling them. So basically the same as we do. The problem is that China is now swimming in debt, over $50 trillion in non-financial debt, which is even higher than the U.S. I mentioned in a recent video how this raises fears of a Japan-style deleveraging with potentially years of slow growth. Deflation, of course, makes all of those debts even bigger. China taking over the world has been the story of the decade, and now it is running into reality. I don't think they're doomed, but they are going to need to pull some big rabbits out of their hats. And what is next for us? Expect China to flood the world with even cheaper goods, which is great for our consumers. It should take some of the edge off inflation short term, but it could also wipe out what's left of American and European manufacturing, both already on the edge from suicidal green mandates. It turns out central planners in China are almost as bad as ours, and now millions get to pay the price. It's a sad day for Greens as a new poll finds British voters overwhelmingly support the climate scheme known as net zero, unless it costs money, in which case they overwhelmingly reject it. Given that every green mandate in existence does cost money, often trillions of it, this implies that if British voters actually knew how much it costs, they would overwhelmingly reject the entire climate agenda, in which case the UK government too would laugh net zero and the rest of the green agenda out of the room. Perhaps they would even arrest activists who throw soup at Picassos. Of course, none of this happens because climate change contains a secret ingredient, lies. Media and governments who drumbeat how it's a free lunch, even as they nibble on lobster and compote in Paris, scheming how to grab another $5 trillion in taxpayer money for green boondoggles. Of course, it's not just the British. A 2019 Canadian study found that while two-thirds of Canadians think the government should fight climate change, in fact, 38% said, quote, our survival depends on it, yet fully three-quarters of Canadians were unwilling to spend more than $9 a month to fight it. Note, those cheapskates would include at least a third of the people who said our survival depends on it. The numbers are similar in the U.S., where a recent AP poll found most Americans think climate change is a problem that needs solving, yet just 28% would pay $10 a month to fight it. In short, voters believe the media and government on climate, but they don't really care. Naturally, this means the key for media and government is to convince voters it's all free. This is challenging since climate has already soaked up tens of trillions of dollars, with many more set to kick in. I did a recent video on summits in Paris and India where they're aiming for $2 to $4 trillion per year for climate. I also mentioned in another recent video how Germany's green mandate sent electricity prices soaring sixfold. That would come to close to $1,000 per month for the average American household. And yet, if you Google cost of renewables online, you'll get page after page trumpeting how they're actually cheaper than fossils, often written by consultants like Lazard, who make a tidy profit consulting companies on sustainability. Of course, if that were true, if renewables actually were cheaper, there'd be no need for governments. In fact, there'd be no need for activists or their soup, because if green really was cheaper, companies, homeowners, motorists would be falling over themselves for the green transition. Governments wouldn't have to lift a finger. After all, if some cardboard box costs a penny less, companies will flood like lemmings into the cheap stuff. But somehow, with green alone, they require trillions of dollars, regulatory mandates, new taxes, even threats to imprison skeptics. What could explain such a mystery? Easy, the books are cooked. Magicked up to hide fixed costs, shell-gamed components and infrastructure. They assume battery technologies or 100-mile power lines that do not exist, but perhaps could someday if we plow enough trillions into it. Alas, regular people don't realize there's a trillion-dollar lobby for greens, supported by power-hungry governments and their subsidy-hungry cronies. Instead, voters see the plucky activists, the useful idiots throwing soup at Picassos, so governments can throw mandates at us while their cronies throw millions at yachts. Thanks for listening. Remember to subscribe to get next week's episode right in your inbox, and visit petersaintange.com for all the videos, archives, and fresh articles about economics and freedom. Okay, we'll be watching. See you next time.